You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And today's show is, well, it's about a landscape, a sense of place and time, I suppose, are the themes that link our guests. Our studio guest is Michael Bravo, talking about his book North Pole, Nature and Culture. We'll also hear from Juliet Blaxland on her book, The Easternmost House, about living on the edge of a cliff in Suffolk. And Harry Sidebottom will be talking about the landscape of ancient Rome and his new standalone novel, The Lost Ten. Michael, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but geography, landscape, has that always been something that's interested you?
Yes, always fascinated by the earth and by travel, and always somehow thinking that traveling was going to be a way to find something, that something out there.
Was that why it interested you? Because you saw it's almost like as a portal to discovery.
Exactly.
Yes. And why the particular places that you've explored? I mean, we'll talk about the North Pole, but why those extremes, if you like?
Mm-hmm. There are two reasons. I think the places that are really worth exploring, you normally can't answer that question before you've been there. So, in the end, I think the extremes are places that tell you something about where you've come from. Somehow, the extremes link up to the very center of the world. And that's a very, something perhaps monastic or seeking some kind of, either fleeing something or seeking sanctuary, some very distant place.
And where did you grow up? Your accent is... I'm not going to hazard a guess.
I speak Canadian.
Oh, I would have guessed Canadian, darn.
You'd have been right. I grew up in Ottawa, and my family traveled quite a lot, actually. We were all born out in South America, in Chile. Of British families, and we wound up in the 60s in Canada.
And what was the landscape like where you were growing up?
Ah, the Ottawa Valley. Wonderful, actually, to grow up in. Partly we grew up on a new burb on agricultural land that was being built on, so there was plenty of, local adventure. But also it's quite a beautiful, there's a lot of outdoors and trees and a national park around the city. So, and water. Canada is so full of rivers and lakes. So everything in life growing up had to do with water.
Very beautiful. And we're going to talk about your book. Let me just get a trivial question out of the way first. Bravo. Is that your real name?
It's my real surname. Yes.
That's a fantastic name. You could only do what you do with a name like that.
Thank you. It came from my father's side of the family. Indeed, his mother's family. Long story, but it's originally a Spanish name, but I think they were Jewish emigres from Eastern Europe who settled in South America.
What a wonderful name to have.
Thank you.
We're going to listen to your first choice of music now. Is music important to you?
It is.
And why this one, Arcade Fire and Joan of Arc?
Oh, well, it's got lots of energy for a start. And Joan of Arc is actually a pretty interesting figure, and much written about and interpreted in so many different ways. But Joan of Arc, in my book and thinking about the polar regions, actually in my life and in the book, women play quite an important part. So even though we tend to think about the polar regions, there's sort of a knee-jerk reaction that it's a man's world. But that couldn't be further from the truth for the societies who live there. And Joan of Arc is this incredible emblem of resistance, of course, perhaps tragic, but nevertheless powerful resistance. So that's how she both resonates with the book and actually with a few mentors that I've had in my life.
You're the one that they used to hate, but they like you now. And everything that goes away, well, it does somehow. they spit on you because they got no heart. I'm the one that will follow you. You're my Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc.
That's Joan of Arc by Arcade Fire, the first choice of music on today's bookmark from our studio guest, Michael Bravo. Michael is a senior lecturer at the University of Cambridge, a fellow of Downing College and head of Circumpolar History and Public Policy Research at the Scott Polar Research Institute. He compiled and co-edited Narrating the Arctic, published in 2002, the hardback copy of which sells at £296.
Yikes.
Apparently. Did you know? You didn't know that, Michael?
I didn't know that.
He also co-edited the more modestly priced Arctic Geopolitics and Autonomy, published in 2010. Last year saw the publication of his first solo work, North Pole, Nature and Culture. The New Scientist described it as rich and insightful. Country Life said it was fascinating, and The Spectator called it sumptuous. Well, it is a beautiful book, Michael. The photos and illustrations in there are absolutely wonderful, reproduced perfectly. You must have been very pleased with that.
I'm delighted and really grateful to my editor and my publisher.
And why the Arctic and not the Antarctic? You were talking about extremes before, but why did you decide to write about the Arctic?
Well, for a start, the Arctic is nearer. But I think the real reason is that the Arctic is very kind of richly inhabited by, there are eight countries around the north, around the polar basin, the Arctic Ocean. But it's inhabited. It's inhabited by societies who've lived there for hundreds of years, if not millennia. And that's what I find interesting. Both that it's somehow this extremely remote place, but you arrive there. You arrive and you are hosted. You're a guest of really interesting societies.
And there have been other books about the North Pole, so you wanted to make this different. What is different about this book? What's it about?
Yeah, this one is really different. I didn't know if there was a book in it when the publisher actually suggested it to me, because most of the books, and there are a lot of them, are about racing to the pole. Who gets there first? It's a destination kind of race genre. I wanted to do something different. Something very visual, as you said. Also quite a lot of ideas in there. And I kind of actually wondered, I thought, well, as you kindly introduced me, I work at a polar institute, and I wondered whether the pole matters anymore. I mean, on the one hand, as you said, the theme of these books today is about place. And the North Pole is kind of peculiar that way, isn't it? It's like a placeless place. It's there because of lines of longitude. They all meet at the North Pole. And yet it's one of those places that when you arrive there, you can't tell looking around whether you're really there or not. So it's a paradox. And I think it's the paradox that is the kernel that grabbed me in the first place.
And now there are, in fact, two poles, because there's the magnetic pole and the actual North Pole.
Yes. Well, actually, there are loads of poles. So initially, the poles that really mattered were the North Pole, and the one that mattered even more was the one above it in the heavens, the celestial pole, because that was in the old hundreds of years ago, that was the line that was the center of the whole universe in Ptolemy's world. And yes, eventually they worked out that there was this different pole, the magnetic pole, and that was quite beguiling because for a long time they thought there must be four of them to account for the movement of a compass. And now, even this century, we have poles of cold, the coldest place on Earth. So actually, there's a good dozen poles, at least, at last count. But those are the main two.
And at one stage, they actually thought it was alive, didn't they? They thought there was kind of a spirit that was pulling things into it.
Yeah, that's right. William Gilbert, who's kind of one of the pioneers of science in the Royal Society and Gresham College and the beginnings of science, that story. So he thought that poles had soul, S-O-U-L, had soul. So try to picture the world before Newton, which is a world where people don't know about the idea of gravity, but they can see that, things fall. They can see that objects in the sky are attracted to each other. So Gilbert, curiously, he's also really, he carried out more experiments on poles and magnetism than anybody before in a very famous work. He did hundreds of experiments using magnetized lodestone, magnetized rock. And yet he's also the person influenced by a long tradition of philosophers going back to Plato, who thought that these weren't kind of dumb or silent poles. These were poles with a kind of energy or a soul in them.
It's easy to sneer now because we know what the pole looks like. We're very used to seeing pictures and film of it. But of course, then, hundreds of years ago, they didn't know what it looked like. And there were all these theories that there were islands and seas there.
Exactly. So Gilbert, in many ways, like so many scientists, come up with brilliant theories that eventually are dispelled, proved wrong, or improved upon. But actually, he became an experimenter. Actually, he spent time in Cambridge, by the way. He was the bursar over at St. John's College before he became a very distinguished, I think, physician to the Queen. But what he really managed to do was he managed to work out that if you make a sphere, if you get a piece of rock and you sculpt it into a sphere and it's magnetized, it has poles. So this was kind of the moment in history where he worked out you could actually make poles. And actually, you could make as many poles as you could make spheres. And if you chopped that sphere into two and you made two more, then you had more poles. And that allowed him, as he said, to kind of have the whole world in his own laboratory.
And it seems there's something about the pole that leads people to study or think about the bigger questions. I think you say a lifetime of knocking on the door of the North Pole led explorers themselves to reflect deeply on the nature of their endeavour.
I think that's right. I mean, you know how travel and exploration is very still alive. It's still a passion for many people. And I'm persuaded now that people don't explore and try to get somewhere in order to reach that place as the end point. It might be the goal, but actually it's to try and understand something. And it might be something about themselves. It might be something that they can't quite articulate, but in a sense the journey for the pole has always been to try to work out what is beyond the pole.
And one of the words you use most often in the book, which interested me, is mystical. It's always been this fascination that the pole has strange powers. We talked about there being a spirit there sucking things in, and that goes back a long way, doesn't it? This idea that there was something magical there.
It does, exactly as you were saying. And partly because the idea of the celestial pole above, you know, in the supposed to be the center of the universe, in those days they thought that the heavens were divine in some ways, and the best we could do on Earth was to try and, you know, move in harmony with the heavens. That's sort of the story of astrology. But explorers, yes, have sought something mystical in the pole, and I think it has a lot to do with power, with political power. So the reason for that, you know, as children we're taught that we, if we live in north of the equator, we're kind of closer to the top of the world. We see ourselves at the top, not the bottom of the world. So the idea that you can kind of look out over the world from above and bestows a kind of power. And it's interesting, as you say, how much that has been tied up with a lot of different mystics. I guess if you're a mystic, it's quite good to place your secrets in a place that's quite hard to get to. But between that and also kind of viewing the world from above means that it's actually produced sort of so many different kinds of myths, actually, not just one.
And it's been in literature as well, isn't it? It appears as this kind of intriguing, mysterious place in literature. I'm thinking of Frankenstein, Coleridge, Jules Verne.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that, thank you, because, well, you'll remember that perhaps that Frankenstein is set in the Arctic at the beginning and the end, sort of the rest of it's the Alps sandwiched in between. It's an Arctic setting. But actually the precursor to Frankenstein is less well known and really important writer named Margaret Cavendish, Duchess of Newcastle. So she's a contemporary of women writers like Aphra Behn. She is married to a nobleman. They spend time in exile in Paris to escape the fate of Charles I. Now, she's very interesting. She, for example, was, I understand, was the first woman to attend meetings at the Royal Society. That's really something. She read deeply in science or natural philosophy, as it was then called. And she writes this incredible story called The Blazing World, which is, some people call it fantasy, but whatever genre it was in 1666 when she published it, it's a story about herself, actually. being imagining being kidnapped at sea, taken away as a bride. But anyway, they're blown off course and the ship is blown up to the North Pole. And all these useless men who've kidnapped her perish. But because of the ardor of her spirit, she survives. And she discovers, a parallel universe, but more specifically, she discovers two worlds that are joined at the pole. So these kind of dual poles. And from there, she enters other worlds. And it's like a series of layers that unfold. So the poles actually take you into these other worlds. And it's a really remarkable story where she ends up meeting what some literary critics have called kind of her other self, who's the empress of this other world. And she encounters this other self. It's very, it's kind of wonderful. And, it comes before Jonathan Swift writes Gulliver's Travels, but you might feel that you're reading something of the same kind.
And you also give a shout out to Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, yes. Who could resist that? Winnie the Pooh and the Christopher Robin's expedition to the North Pole. And so they all go off on an expedition and they discover the North Pole. And then just at the end there, I think someone has the bright idea of maybe going to discover the East Pole. And then it kind of fades away.
Well, thank you, Michael. We'll come back to you and talk to you more about the North Pole. Let's move on to another kind of literature now. Juliet Blaxland is a writer, architect, cartoonist and illustrator. Her cartoon series Life in a Listed Building was published in the Prince of Wales's architecture magazine Perspectives and won a prize at the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition. Her first adult non-fiction work, The Easternmost House, was published this year and tells of her experience living in a house on a crumbling cliff at the easternmost edge of England. The Sunday Times described it as brilliant, and Country Life said of it, "It's a hymn to a simpler life, one rooted more in tune with the rhythms of the natural world, its wonders and its perils." I met Juliet when she was visiting Cambridge and she talked to me about the book and why she wrote it.
We live on the edge of the eroding cliff at Eastern Bavance, which was the easternmost point of the whole of Britain. And we've been there for about 12 years. And I think the sort of spark was in 2015, where the house that was on the edge beyond us was demolished. And therefore, rather like when your parents are still alive, would it be rude to say that you feel a sense of security because there's a whole buffer of another generation. And so when this house was demolished, it focused the mind. I had written parts and thoughts and I suddenly galvanised myself and thought, actually, this could be a book, but it needs a hook. You can't just say, I'm living on the edge of an eroding cliff, because actually so are many other people. I knew just from my general knowledge that Eastern Bavance had been the easternmost parish in the whole of the UK and actually the easternmost point of land. That combination of the house being demolished and the sense of it being the easternmost point made me think, how do I anchor this book? I had read a book sometime before called The Outermost House, which was A Year of Life on the Great Beach at Cape Cod by Henry Beston. And I sort of revisited that book because he was bemoaning how modern people are disconnected from nature. And I also had a soft spot for Gavin Maxwell and Ring of Bright Water. The whole thing of living slightly apart from the mass of humanity, which both those books do. So then I literally just sat down and wrote it as a sort of marshalling of thoughts. And although I say it's a year of life, it's actually a mashup of all of the time we've been there. Each chapter heading has a quote from something like the Book of Common Prayer or something rather ancient, which relates to the past, but also it seems relevant today. When you can look to the past so easily because you can see the land is lost and you can look at an old map and have a sort of vague sense of local memory of it, it makes it quite easy to then look into the future. So then at the end of the book, I look to the future because obviously there's going to be an awful lot more water around the East Anglian coast coming in over the Wash, coming in the estuaries, the Broads. The erosion isn't necessarily physical. There's a kind of cultural erosion, bit by bit. Old traditional livelihoods, livestock farming. So it mostly is about living with nature and the loveliness of being right on the edge and how you experience enormous storms and bird migrations and the sand martins arriving. Those sort of seasonal things are perennial. When you're on the edge of a cliff, seeing electric storms over the sea and quite dark skies, you actually feel more connected to the world. The destructive force of the erosion is absolutely palpable. And in a storm, there's no getting away from the fact that you're losing 25 acres of arable land a year or something. So from a human perspective, it is destruction and damaging, and it's threatening people's houses. We've had a night where a whole dune disappeared. We've had another night with a sort of tidal surge. A rather attractive bay formed overnight that made our access to the beach actually much easier and much more attractive. So it's destructive, but it's also constructive. I've become a little bit more open to nature's own ways of dealing with things. It's just change, it's not necessarily a bad thing. We're on borrowed time, and I think what happens is you get some sort of demolition order and a fairly good common sense visual warning, like we can personally see how much time we've got, and we would make some sort of plan. And then eventually what will happen is sort of yellow digger comes and demolishes it. It will be strange, and I think it will be compulsive viewing, actually, to look at the house where you've lived and you've spent quite a lot of time, and seeing the rooms where you've been happy. It does give you a quite different perspective on time. We really can see the edge of the cliff coming towards our house. It's impossible not to see, that was a bit of a metaphor for your own time running out. It's obvious, but it does focus the mind on how am I spending my time, how am I spending my year. We've been there 12 years, and you see physically 20, 25 metres has vanished. If you could have that time back, would you? And actually, quite a lot of the time you think, no, actually, I don't really want that time. I don't really want to relive. I want different time. It's the future now. It's not a sort of bad thing, but it is different from living in a normal, solid house, in a normal, solid place. So I know that the house I live in now, 5 years it won't be there, and certainly in 10, it's very likely that I will outlive the house that we live in, and that's quite an unusual perspective. I thought a little bit about trying to give some sense of posterity, some of its history, some of the people who'd lived there that I know, some of them I don't know. There are pictures of the listening station in the war, which was a sort of bedraggled old farm building as I knew it. But then when I saw an old photo, it had all these radar sort of listening towers, and it was really quite an important little building doing its bit for the war effort. And obviously being on the coast, you're strategically important. And even now, for things like Trooping the Colour or any big royal anniversary or jubilee or whatever, the flypast forms up right over exactly where we live. So you look up into the sky and you think, every time, I've missed it, I've timed it wrong. And then out of the clouds comes the perfect flypast, all formed up. I think they use Southwold Pier as the lineup, and then they head off straight over Buckingham Palace. And that, in its own way, makes you feel connected to the rest of the world. We've done all these things, other people have done all these things there. There are people come and they fish, and masses of people coming and staying and having lunch, and real human life. And unless I give some sense of the place and the people who've been before us, and a sense of how we live now, this easternmost parish, easternmost church, easternmost place of the whole of the UK would be lost to the memory, really, because it's not an important enough place. But Eastern Bavance is rather interesting, not least because it is the easternmost point. First of all, I thought we had quite an interesting life there, so I thought people might be interested in it. Secondly, I thought it might bridge a little bit the gap between sort of town and country, because we have so many visitors that come only to the coast, but they don't really understand or see what goes on in the wider farming area of people I've known all my life, and what happens in winter when they're not there. And I thought they might find it interesting. And now, with the book having been published, it'll be in the Bodleian Library, and it'll be in whoever's memory of people who've read it, and it's got my photos in it. And there's this sense that it'll just be the beach and air above your head where we've lived. And if I didn't write it, nobody would know. None of that would be in anybody's mind. And therefore, there is a sense of this quite thriving, funny little separate world. What I had in mind, partly when I wrote it, was what would it be like if you were in a tube tunnel or on a train? Did it feel as if you could take this little cottage and this windblown place with you? And in a way, I hope it would. In the summer, it can be extremely attractive. It's like living in a sort of Mediterranean idyll. But in the winter, it can be like living on a wind-lashed trawler, and it can be extremely windy and quite bleak, actually. But I grew up in the country, and I'm used to weather and having to be outside. I've always rather missed the wide skies, and you couldn't get much wider than that. You look out onto what is just a horizontal line on the land and the sea, and I find that oddly a relief from the clutter of everybody. So it isn't everybody's cup of tea, but it really is an amazing, interesting experience, and I really hope that I've managed to capture it in a moment in history, really, before it goes. The house we live in is really the last of old Eastern Bavants, the last memory of that real hamlet, poking out like a nose into the North Sea, and this is the last fragment of it, really.
And The Easternmost House by Juliet Blaxland is published by Sunstone Press. And listening to that with me on Bookmark today is our studio guest, Michael Bravo, here to talk about his book, North Pole, Nature and Culture. Was there things resonating in what Juliet was saying, even though the landscape is very different?
Completely. I think we need to pay a lot more attention to what Juliet is saying about the coast. She asks, or kind of suggests, that this gets us to think about what is solid about where we live and the ground that we build on. And gosh, I've got a colleague who looks at some very similar kinds of stories in Alaska, in the native communities of Shishmaref, for example, where what one might have thought was solid is no longer. So both there's the Arctic sea ice that is not exactly eroding, but diminishing and melting year on year. And that with the Antarctic ice shelf is causing sea levels to rise, so that our glaciological colleagues are hard at work on that. But also with the as the sea ice melts in Alaska, there's a barrier that's kind of disappearing that's quite similar. So the action of the water is causing erosion and eating away in a very kind of almost identical way on the shoreline of Shishmaref. And there are some famous photographs of the houses tipping over, which will require either, as she says, for she may be the last inhabitant there, or for the whole community to be relocated at great cost. So we're talking about landscape refugees, I guess.
And I didn't ask you, but how many times have you been to the North Pole?
I've never been to the North Pole.
You've never been?
No. Partly on purpose. I mean, it costs quite a lot to get there. And there are some good things to do up at the North Pole. There are marathons that are run there, and scientists set up camps to study the sea ice. So as well as thinking that it's important to have places you dream of and to go, I kind of also think it's important to have places that are important to you because you won't go there. The North Pole's been one of those places for me.
Oh, so I was going to ask you, had it changed over the time that you've been visiting? But I suppose you don't need to have visited to know that it's changed. We see those images, as you say, of glaciers collapsing.
Yeah, because in the middle of the Arctic Ocean, you have moving sea ice, and it's moving because of the ocean currents that circulate through the Arctic Ocean and the basin. And they tend to go over from the Bering Strait on the Russian side, the Alaskan side, over past Greenland to the European Asian side. There's no doubt that the multi-year sea ice, the really old sea ice, is thinning. Its concentrations are much diminished. There's no doubt that that's happening. And in many instances now, the video cams that NOAA, the American agency responsible for this, sets up, they, you know, they're lakes. I mean, sometimes there's no ice at the North Pole. So this is a change of a kind that's very clearly taking place.
And when you know that, how does it feel when you hear people denying climate change?
I'm not surprised that people deny it. It makes me, of course, I worry. I worry about the future of the ecosystems that we are leaving for our children and grandchildren. They will grow up in a world that's quite different to the one that we've experienced. I don't know if it's optimism, but I also think that most of the big issues in life are solved through education. So that's really how I kind of view denial. I mean, there might be various interests at play behind climate change denial, but actually, I'm as worried by the lack of, people in the House of Commons who have a background in science. I think that does matter. I think many friends who are journalists and so on, they tend to come from the humanities. So I think kind of passionately, we need to make sure that science is something that we all have a reasonable grip on. And you don't have to be a scientist to read science.
Well, let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is Head Full of Doubt by the Yvette Brothers. Why this one?
Well, I love the Yvette Brothers, and I saw them for the first time at the Green Man Festival in Wales, and they were brilliant on stage. I think they hail from North Carolina. They're brilliant on their instruments. I love their strings. The Head Full of Doubt is, I guess it's maybe autobiographical, but also because these questions about where you travel are also questions about your inner self. And I've always been just as interested, if not more, in what happens to us when we get lost as when we find our way. And Head Full of Doubt, I think, is about that.
There's a darkness upon me that's flooded in light. In the fine print they tell me what's wrong and what's right. And it comes in black and it comes in white, and I'm frightened by those who don't see it.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And let's hear from Harry Sidebottom now on Bookmark. Harry has written 6 novels in the Warrior of Rome series and 3 in the Throne of the Caesars series. He's steeped in ancient history and is a fellow and director of studies in the subject at Oxford University. The Lost Ten, his first standalone novel for some time, it's what thriller writer Rory Clements describes as a cracking tale with more twists and turns than the Tiber itself. When I met Harry, I asked him what The Lost Ten is about.
The Lost Ten is an action-adventure thriller in which the 10 of the title are sent on a desperate rescue mission hundreds of miles behind enemy lines. Right from the start, you, the reader, from chapter 1, know that all is not as it should be, and one of the 10 is almost certainly a traitor.
And this is a standalone novel?
It is, yes. It's a completely standalone. It's set in the same time period as my others, and it makes a passing reference for people who've read the other novels to some of the characters in the others, but no, it's completely standalone.
How did that feel, writing a standalone novel after all these years writing books in series?
It was quite weirdly liberating, because the problem with doing a book in a series is the continuity. And you're always thinking, hang on a sec, it's at the Emma Bovary level, does this character have blue eyes or green eyes? But it's also, how do they think, how do they speak? And you spend an awful lot of time when doing a series rereading your own stuff, which is obviously always a really painful experience.
You weren't tempted with any of these characters? You didn't think, oh, actually, I could take them a bit further?
Ah, funny you should say that. Yes, the handful who are alive at the end of the book, certainly one or two of them might reappear in further fiction.
And it's been described as a fast-paced thriller with a hard-edged appeal of Bravo 2.0. Do you like that as a review?
I'm perfectly happy with that. No, actually, I am happy with that. I mean, with this book, I wanted to try and turn back to the sort of adventure thrillers, classics I loved when I was a kid, and still now and then reread for pure pleasure. Alistair MacLean, Guns and Other Own, things like that. But I wanted to update them to make them harder edged and a bit darker, a bit more realistic. And I think that's where the Bravo 2.0 comparison comes in. So that's what I'm aiming for. Alistair MacLean for the 21st century.
And there's a lot about battle and conflict. Nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction aside, has much changed in that field, do you think?
At the very basic level of a soldier in the field, an awful lot has stayed the same. The same tiredness. You're hot, tired, hungry, or cold, wet, and you're always frightened. The idea of men, male grace under pressure, as Hemingway would have it, really doesn't change. an awful lot has changed. Actually, one of the strange changes, of course, the characters in my book aren't Christians. So they don't have hang-ups about killing people. In fact, almost the reverse. It's a sign of manliness to be a killer.
And once they're dead, that's it. They don't see themselves going on to another life.
Now, that's one of the extraordinary things about the Greeks and Romans is the sheer miserableness of Hades. I mean, at best, you sort of flit around like a bat, squeaking and gibbering, only sentient enough to envy the living. I mean, it's not paradise for 70 virgins, is it? I mean, they can't be dragooned into battle with, you know, better things will happen when you're dead, which actually makes the courage they show almost more praiseworthy, in a sense.
And from the description, some people might think this is a macho book. Are there little softer subtexts in there?
Well, I hope there are. I always get slightly irritated when people describe my books as being boys' own books. In fact, one early review said, this is obviously a boys' own book. Well, yes and no. It was also praised in the New York Times by Don Leon, who, as far as I'm aware, is not a boy. But yes, there are. I mean, there are female characters. The main female character actually has a very bad time, but then again, so do all the male characters. That's one of the joys of writing fiction. As Martin Amis said, you invent people to give them a really bad time.
You can work out all your angst and anger.
And a schadenfreude of, at least I'm not living through that. Let's see what it'd be like to imagine living through something very, very horrible.
When you're writing, do you have a reader in mind?
Actually, no, not really. I know some writers do, but I don't. I think it'd be very limiting. I think it kind of would railroad you into writing in a certain sort of way, certain sort of style, maybe even certain sorts of stories. It sounds ridiculous. If I have a reader in mind, it's me. Someone who likes fast-paced thrillers, but also wants a bit of meat on the bone. So it's not all two-dimensional, and there is a certain, hopefully, depth to characters. And, of course, as in all my books, loads of history, which I hope is seamlessly folded in and never an info dump at all.
Yes, the history, as you are steeped in that, because your day job is involved with classics as well. Are you still finding things in that world to inspire you in the fictional world?
Oh, absolutely. Well, this book, The Lost Ten, entirely comes from reading Procopius's histories. He was a Byzantine historian of the 6th century AD. And about 10, 15, God, it might be me 20 years ago, I read him, and in it was this wonderful story, an anecdote about a place called the Castle of Silence, which is, it was, a Persian prison where high-profile political prisoners were sent. Once a man was condemned there, or a woman, it became a capital crime to ever mention their name. And I thought, oh, wow. As soon as I read it, I thought, that's going to be a novel one day. So, yes, very much so. This is directly inspired, possibly, apart from Count Belisarius by Robert Graves, the only novel directly inspired by Procopius for quite a long time.
And are there areas of life in that period that you've not explored yet that you'd like to?
Yes, all sorts of areas. Off the top of my head, the theatre is one. I've never had really anything in any of my 11 novels about the theatre. I would also like to do more, I know it sounds a bit cliche, but about chariot racing and mass entertainment. I've never done a gladiator novel. Everyone does. That's kind of why I've steered away from them. Researching the novels actually makes me a better historian because I have to read about and think about stuff that my day job as an Oxford Don has never made me think about. Christianity, food, clothes, houses, all these things I'd managed to teach at Oxford for donkey's years and never mention. But in a novel, you kind of need to know what they're wearing, what they're eating.
And I suppose, yes, you need to think about the diversity of life and the diversity of experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. And in this novel, that's one thing I tried very much, the cultural mix, because it's not just Romans and others. The characters themselves are from a wide range of backgrounds, including Easterners, and they're travelling across Mesopotamia, which is this fascinating, almost Wild West borderland at the time between the Persian and Roman empires, but with its own indigenous cultures. They're sort of coming together. And it's sometimes hard for the main characters to work out who they're dealing with in this novel because they're from the West. They don't understand the rules of the game. Who are these people? Are they nomadic Arabs? Are they bandits? Are they just locals? Which hopefully adds to a certain air of tension because you, the reader, like the characters, don't know, hopefully, when the next ambush, the next bad thing is going to happen. Are these just innocent herders, or are they the bad people hiding their weapons?
And what's next for you?
I'm halfway through writing the next novel, which will come out in 2020. So far, it's provisionally titled The Return. Still in Rome, but much, much earlier. It's set in 146 BC. The elevator pitch, as publishers like, is a veteran returns from the sack of the city of Corinth to his farm in Calabria, for no better reason than I like Calabria and I want to send a novel there. And as soon as he gets home, he's, in our terms, suffering from combat stress. In his terms, he's obviously demon-haunted. And you, the reader, won't know why. What awful thing has he done that has left this guilt? You won't know till the end of the novel. But as soon as he comes home, bodies start appearing, hideously mutilated, in the forest of Sela. And he has to track them down, the killers down, with the slight edge, of course, that he might be the killer.
Oh, that sounds good.
It's my attempt to mix together the historical novel and Scandi Noir. Ragnar Jonasson meets Gladiator, as the publisher might probably pitch it. Girl with a Dragon Tattoo meets Spartacus.
And The Lost Hen by Harry Sidebottom is published by Zafra. We've been talking on Bookmark today to Michael Bravo about his book North Pole, Nature and Culture, which is published by Reaction Books, Reaction with a K. We're coming to the end of our time with you, sadly, Michael, but time for a few more questions. You said right at the beginning that one of the reasons you wrote this book was to see whether the North Pole still really mattered. What did you conclude?
I've concluded it matters far more than I'd realised, and maybe that's a good thing. But it matters because it turns out it's a story about orientation and about how we understand where we are, which is something somehow, as a society or a species, we're constantly seeking to do. And you know, the best example is the compass. The compass needle supposedly shows us, you know, orients us to our way, right, to the true north, whatever that means. But when you go to the North Magnetic Pole, that's where the compass needle doesn't work. So in a way, what it does, by the way, if you're up in the Arctic, is it starts either spinning in a circle one way and then back the other. So when we come too close to the things that tell us who we are, they stop working. And the North Pole, I think, matters more than ever because actually it's been central to the history of the globe. I mean, in some very obvious way, where all our lines of latitude and longitude and our sense of place, as you said earlier, our myths actually have a lot to do with this defining place. And at the North Pole at 90 degrees north, there is no time zone, you might know. It's timeless.
And I know that you're very interested in the Inuit who live there. That you really got into this by encounters with them.
Yeah, when I was young, I worked up in the north of Canada with the Inuit of the High Arctic, up in the archipelago and the islands. And I made friends and started collaborating with Zacharias Kunuk and other Inuit who were making videos. So imagine this for the first time. They have satellites in the 1970s, before satellites are in Europe. And they're using this facility to make films about their own culture in their own language, broadcast every week. On their radio. So we used to go hunting or out on expeditions to film with elders, reflecting on how life was changing. So it was really formative. And it was, I suppose, it's Inuit philosophy about life sees life fundamentally as a dialogue. Extremes are always about contests, about love, or about feuds. And it was a really, a special experience being able to work with them.
And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Yeah, funnily enough, I probably, like lots of people, I've been reading a book called White by Bret Easton Ellis, who's been touring.
American Psycho Man.
Yes, and a controversial novelist and book. Quite interesting that in American Psycho, you know, the hero of the serial killer is a person named Donald J. Trump. And so he's had a lot to say about that. And I've found it interesting to hear him reflect on his own history.
Oh, thank you, Michael. We'll come back to you in just a moment to your final piece of music. We should say as well that you're appearing at the Stoke Newington Literary Festival tomorrow. Sunday, the 9th of June.
Yes. That's right. Thank you.
Next show, a studio guest is investigative journalist Stephen Davis, talking about his book Truth Teller, an expose on the worlds of truth prevention, fake news and conspiracy theories. We'll also hear from Catherine Lawless, talking about her novel Beach Hut and how writing it helped her deal with severe agoraphobia. And Claire Hanscom will be chatting about her novel Unscripted. But we'll sign out now, Michael, with your last choice of music, which is Penderecki Sonata No. 2 for violin and piano. Why this one?
Thank you. Well, Penderecki is very special, both because my youngest child, my daughter, kindly arranged for me a surprise to hear Penderecki's music. Sonata played by Anne-Sophie Mutter at the Royal Festival Hall, so that's very special. Also because it's incredible music, and he's writing about resistance in the country from which my father's family originally came and sought refuge.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for being here today. Thank you.